Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Lori Lightfoot's Summer of Joy is off in earnest. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I don't know if anything that transpired this weekend altered how you view the city and how much time you're going to spend down in the city or not, particularly for those suburbanites I'm talking about, and even exurbanites. But after seeing what happened at Millennium Park over the weekend, after seeing some of the other video and images of droogs roaming the tourist areas, the River North and the Gold Coast, over the weekend, throwing chairs at cars passing by and so forth. Will you be taking in dinner and a movie in the city, or dinner and a show in the city this summer? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Or even a walk in the park. I mean, there was, my friend went to pick up her son because there's other than thugs, you know, bum rushing Millennium Park, and said she saw a bride and her bridesmaid running for their life out of Millennium Park because there was mobs of people coming and it didn't stop. And they said, what you see on TV, that was nothing. You had to be there. It was sickening. You mentioned that they were, because then when they got done and a 16-year-old was shot, and I don't know if you saw that video. My kids showed me that last night. It's horrific. You can see him taking his last breath, and there's blood all over his shirt. And you can see the moments before. You know, they just want, everybody wanted to record a fight. Everyone wanted to be there. They were bored. Chicks were fighting. People were pulling hair. Then after the shooting, then it just continued down the street, and people are throwing, as you mentioned, chairs at cars just for, you know, just for the fun of it. And this is what it sounded like.
They finna get run over by these civilian
cars. Just running in front of cars.
Look. Look at this, y'all.
Screaming at the top of their lungs. But if a driver in the car waved at them, Dan, if a driver waved, then they didn't attack that car.
Uh-huh. And so, I mean, 31 and 5 are sort of a customary weekend in the spring and the summer in Chicago. 31 dead, 31 shot, 5 dead, including that 16-year-old that you mentioned. I was down in River North. I went to RPM Seafood on Saturday night. And it's just interesting. If you've spent any time in the city, so, I mean, there's no, it's fine at RPM Seafood. Then you walk down Clark into these little entertainment districts they've set up, or they've blocked off portions of Clark for the restaurants. And by 11 o'clock, it's pretty much cleared out. You walk around and you see on Clark and on Hubbard, which was supposed to be one of these new entertainment districts of the last half a dozen years. I find it to be very ghetto. It's not a pleasant or welcoming environment, I'll tell you that. And then you walk up a little further north towards the Gold Coast. And, I mean, by 11:30, there is no Gold Coast. That's all shut down. On a Saturday night in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, as you stroll through the city, you hear the din of sirens everywhere, and you smell marijuana everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's just such a, it's just become, in addition to the lack of safety, which is, of course, the preeminent concern, it's just become an unpleasant environment to be around, and so much so that these restaurants and bars are closing. I mean, closing before midnight on a Saturday night, not because they don't want to make money. That's not because I think for most of them, it's not even because they have staffing problems. That's because it's unsafe.
It's a safety issue. And so Mayor Lightfoot's solution, she's banning unaccompanied minors in Millennium Park after 6 p.m. from Thursday through Sunday.
Yeah. So the curfew.
The curfew. Right.
So I remember back in December when a CTA driver was brutalized right there around Millennium Park, that the suggestion that was made by people like me that these kids, unaccompanied minors, don't get to access, to use the politicians' weasel words, don't get to access the city when and how they want. That's not how it should work, particularly if they're going to access it in a way that is disorderly at a minimum. And that was called racist by deep thinkers in the Chicago press corps like Greg Hines. We had him on the show to talk about it, you'll recall. So now that Lori Lightfoot has done it, now that Lori Lightfoot has said exactly what we said back in December after that CTA driver was brutalized by another gang of droogs roaming the streets, Clockwork Orange style, I guess all those race hustlers, you can direct your phony baloney ire towards triple threat now that she's instituted
curfew. The policy director for Raise the Floor and the 25th Ward deputy Dem committee person tweeting out, you know, the police are going to use this as a reason to harass and jail young black children. I promise you.
Whatever. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
She needs to do something because, you know, the shooting happened not at 11:30 at night, or it happened at 7:30. And there were tourists there and they were running for their lives. There's so much footage out there of people just scared, you know, whatless. And that's a Chicago I don't ever want to be a part of. And I don't feel safe with my kids. I don't feel safe with anybody going downtown. I will never go to Millennium Park ever again.
So no Sea Dog, no Ferris wheel for you this summer. No.
My kids are going to prom.
Dinner and an off-Broadway show.
They're all going to Navy Pier for a prom. A lot of different, and I'm scared for them to do that. I really am.
It's not just a Chicago problem, but it's particularly a Chicago problem. Milwaukee.
Oh my God!
Milwaukee on Sunday canceled the citywide
viewing.
You know,
party.
Watch the Bucks get blown out by the Celtics in Game 7 because of safety concerns.
Yeah, the night before when they had a viewing party, all hell broke loose. 21 people were shot in Milwaukee. I don't know how many died, but I bet 21 were shot because they're having these viewing parties that turn just crazy. I don't know what is wrong with people. I don't know.
And on the matter of Kim Fox and what's going to happen, the Chicago police are the problem. They're going to harass young black men and so on and so forth. You know, there's some simple things here and cases that just highlight why things are the way they are in the city. Not exclusively, but this is an important variable. Another story comes to us from CWB Chicago. Prosecutors say an 18-year-old man who racked up 25 arrests as a juvenile and who has 3 carjacking cases pending was part of an armed crew that robbed a Boys Town convenience store at gunpoint. And when police arrested him, he allegedly said he couldn't have been involved in the robbery because he was busy selling drugs at the time. great alibi.
Oh my gosh.
He was finally held without bond at the request of Kim Fox's office, prosecutor on the case. But here is the point. 25 arrests, 3 carjacking cases pending, and he's out in March such that he can be part of a armed crew robbing a Boys Town convenience store. It's just not that complicated, and it's not about harassing young black boys or harassing this color or that color. It is simply the ask. Simply the ask. Repeat. Like, you know, 24 arrests, 3 pending felony charges. Remove, repeat offenders from the street.
And
can you just do that?
on Saturday night. 30 were arrested and 26 of them minors. And I want somebody, I wish we could follow who's going to get what, if anything.
Betsy on the north side.
Yeah, hi. I hope you can hear me okay.
Mm-hmm.
Could you on speaker briefly? I'm sorry because I have to do something. But, I, you know, when Amy mentioned, you know, first of all, I love your show, and I listen as often as possible, first thing in the morning. And I, when Amy mentioned the bicyclist, it immediately touched me because I'll try to say this calmly. I have a very dear friend who, while riding her bike along Lakeshore Drive, our beautiful lake, she not only was physically assaulted brutally, but she was raped. And this is a woman who's what people would call middle-aged. And I will tell you, the effects of violence upon anyone, especially women, I must say, and young children, it affects the whole family. It affected not only her husband, her children, and even if you could believe it, Amy, I know you can relate to this, and Dan, it even affected her cat. Because you know how sensitive animals are. And they, well, they pick know. Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. They
know when you're
up.
Sad.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, I would never name the person, but it actually became sort of a famous case in a way, in an unfortunate way. But I just wanted to say, unfortunately, I warn all Chicagoans, because I was one of those people that rode my bike all the time along the lake. You know, I was always a great athlete. And it happens in the middle of the day, and you don't expect it. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, your life is ruined. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you all. You do a great job for the city. Thanks.
Thank you, Betsy. Appreciate that. You're right. I mean, it's a great point you make. We talk about murders and shootings, other violent crimes, class X felonies like rape. But I'm sorry what happened to your friend. Of course, that is life altering. You survive these attacks, but you're never the same. And those around you who care about you are never the same either. It's absolutely right. And it's not talked about enough. I mean, even again, over the weekend, we're focusing on the flash mobs downtown for good reason, but that's not the only part of the conversation. Chicago police warning residents Rogers Park, Edgewater, to watch out for a thief who targeted 5 victims in a 1-hour period on Saturday. Walks up, threatens a victim with a gun, takes their stuff, jumps into a car, takes off 5 times in an hour in Rogers Park in Edgewater. You know, getting stuck up at gunpoint. That's something that leaves an indelible mark, too.
Yeah.
I suspect people who've unfortunately had that experience would say the carjackings, even when you're not hurt, it doesn't mean there's not trauma associated with
it. There's trauma.
Daniel in Evanston.
I think we need to start tracking the phones of repeat violent offenders. I think eventually cities are going to have to start doing this. Because the fact is, these guys do carry around trackers and false phones. So
well, yeah.
I think we should start talking about that. Because just knowing that somebody from, this is going to sound very bad, but somebody from some store has been sitting in on a corner in Lincoln Park for 4 hours in the middle of the night, you know, we could prevent a lot of crime.
Potentially, thanks for the call, Daniel, but number one, you know, there's burner phones.
Right.
Number two, this is a county that can't track people on electronic monitoring.
Right. That are, some of them are charged with murder and on electronic monitoring.
Some of them,
yeah.
Like 5 dozen last year, I think we're more north of a dozen this year. But also it's not even a technology issue. It's a competency issue. But I think even more so, we talk about often, it's a willpower issue. who has the political will to do the things that are necessary within the confines of the Constitution and the rule of law to remove people from civil society who have demonstrated through their behavior they don't belong in civil society. Who has the political willpower? The leadership of the city doesn't. Jeff in Lincolnshire.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to figure out what the outrage is here. I mean, people have property insurance, car insurance, the businesses have insurance. Heck, some of these victims might even have life insurance. I see this as a non-issue. Right. I'm being sarcastic.
I got it. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call, Jeff.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, talking about violence in Chicago over the weekend, in Milwaukee for that matter. Violence in Buffalo of a different sort. The supermarket shooting in Buffalo where 10 people were murdered by a teenager who apparently, according to the reports, was motivated on the basis of race.
Yeah, drove 200 miles from his home to target a predominantly black grocery store.
10 of the 13 people that were shot were black. 11 of the victims, I'm sorry, 10 people shot and killed, 3 injured, 11 of the victims, 11 of the 13 were black. And there's apparently, as the reports indicate, there's a manifesto that this shooter wrote that suggests that he was inspired by racism. On his gun, he had the N-word written, reportedly. He also had the number 14, which may allude to a 14-word statement attributed to a white supremacist organization. The 14 words, quote, "We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white people," unquote. He also reportedly had the name of one of the Waukesha Christmas Parade victims scrawled on his rifle.
Really?
That was reported. With a phrase, "Here's your reparations." So this is, two more pieces of this. One is that this authorities believe he began planning this attack in January of this year, according to, I guess, this 180-page manifesto that is attributed to the shooter. In addition to that, he previously threatened to shoot up his high school, which led school officials to push for a mental health evaluation into this guy.
Yeah, basically his senior year he had to write an essay, and the essay included how he dreamed of killing people at his school and then killing himself.
So mental health evaluation, and yet he was able to legally purchase the guns that were used in this massacre.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, the guns that he purchased were legal, but he did have also a high-capacity magazine, which is illegal in New York. But I don't think he really cared about that.
The state police did the investigation, that led to him being referred for counseling, mental health counseling. I'm especially in the early hours and days after something like this, you need more information to make an informed decision about whether or not there were people who fell down on the job, whether it should have been obvious that this person, number one, shouldn't be legally authorized to buy guns, and number two, should be monitored a little bit more closely than just referring him for counseling. But as we've talked about in other shootings like these, unfortunately, it's not so linear it's not so easy necessarily to connect the dots. We've talked to Theodore Dalrymple, the great psychiatrist from the UK, about this as well. So, well, the problem is you think that it's so obvious after the fact because you see these indicators, but there are many more cases where those same indicators are present and the person never commits any acts of violence. So it's not so just so easy to look at this in hindsight. So we'll see, but so this is part of the conversation, part of trying to understand what happened. Obviously, the focus is going to be on his radicalization online, which is alleged, and the words that he used both in his manifesto and apparently scrawled on his gun that suggests this racial motivation, and whether or not this is something indicative of our larger racist society and the threat of white supremacy and white supremacists and all that sort of commentary you get from the Biden administration and, frankly, race hustlers, which includes the Biden administration, about crime and what present the real threats to peaceful society in this country.
President Biden and Jill are going to be visiting Buffalo tomorrow. And the governor, yes, she said, this anti-Semite, it's a disease. She sounded like she was talking about COVID.
This person intended to have a broad platform, live streaming it, sharing his information, his ideas, his hatred online. There are others who know this now. And that's what scares me, is how far this virus is now spreading and how quickly.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And he was streaming the shooting because he started in the parking lot on this gaming platform, and he had a helmet camera.
Uh-huh. Here's where this is going to go for the left, because they're shameless and craven and ghoulish and disingenuous. It was Tucker Carlson's fault.
It's always his fault.
That's where this is going to go.
Or Trump's fault.
Let me give you an example. Juliette Kayyem, writing at The Atlantic, Steve Jobs' widow's publication. The manifesto, referring to the shooter's manifesto, is an ode to a particular variant of hate. Espoused by political and conservative media leaders, there you go, called Great Replacement Theory, pulled from European extremist fear of Muslim immigrants, and the American variant has grown out of undeniable demographic shifts. The year Donald Trump was elected president was also the first year the Census Bureau reported more non-white babies born in America than white babies. The country is not going back to a white majority. At the core, this is her writing, not my commentary. At its core, the idea of a great replacement is about violence, because the notion of displacement justifies the elimination of the parties responsible for taking your place. Their very presence, not their ideas or politics or voting patterns, is the threat. Political and media leaders who spread these ideas can play coy, a notion I've described as stochastic terrorism. Well, aren't you clever? By having plausible deniability about what, in fact, they're promoting. The language may be vague as to place and time of the kill, but it isn't misleading. It is terror executed by the herd. So it is not a lone wolf here. It is not a one-off. It is part of the rich tapestry of conservative leaders promoting a great replacement theory. They are responsible for what happened in Buffalo, and they present a domestic terror threat to our nation. That's what she's writing. That's what she's saying. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I always enjoy this stilted analysis from the left, where they force things through disagreements over policy, by the way, that actually make the country less safe. So this is the way they don't have to talk about border security.
Right.
and the hundreds of thousands of people, Americans, black, white, and other, who are victimized by people who shouldn't be in this country because they're not here legally. And repeat offenders, like we're talking about in the streets of Chicago. Repeat offenders we see again and again. But the federal government can't do anything about it because it doesn't have the willpower.
And so
the suggestion is that we don't want the other to come to this country. We don't want the other to have children, to have a family, which is untrue. I'm not a proponent of everything that Tucker Carlson says, particularly in this area. But this idea that we're going to not even blame shift, but fold in conservative leaders, so political and media, and suggest that there's where the real responsibility lies because they are the propagators of a culture that breeds this sort of hate. No, you can't let that stand. You cannot let that stand. And point of fact, the best line and the most enjoyable to repudiate and to give lie to is the idea that it is demographic shifts, a concern that more, as she writes, more non-white babies were born in America than white babies in 2016. Really? Who are the pro-lifers, Ms. KM? Who are the people that talk about how Planned Parenthood targets black women and children in inner cities for abortion on demand? Who's promoting a culture of life and saying we want black, white, Latino, at all children to be born? And there's no quota when we say that. There's no only so many of this color and only so many of that color. No. Every child. Every single child. That's the position. Who are the promoters of school choice against the left and their teachers' union financiers? Who are the people who say, I want black and brown children disproportionately who do not have access to quality K through 12 to have the same access to quality K through 12 that Dan Proft got in the suburbs? Who says that? The left? So we at the same time don't want to be displaced that as we're promoting, number one, their existence, and it should be protected, and number two, their success in this country. But tell me again how conservative media and political leaders are fomenting a hate and a deep-seated resentment of this color or that color at this amount or that amount. It's a bunch of nonsense. Yeah, there are white supremacists, and this guy is an illustration of something the left also can't bring themselves to talk about, which is that evil exists in this world. And evil manifested itself, unfortunately, in Buffalo over the weekend. And that has nothing to do with the sensible political discussion in this country. But these are not sensible people. They're vultures. Julia KM and others like her. So be on the lookout for it because that's what's coming. It's already here. Tony, Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. Well, I find it interesting that Milwaukee shooting was on Thursday or Friday. 7 dead. How many were shot? 11, 15. Not a peep. 21. Not a peep out of the national news. And as abhorrent as the shooting was in Buffalo, you just look at the coverage, and there's such a focus to divide white and black in this country at all levels. And I think we have a bigger race problem than we had back in the 60s because we're in a different period where there's more awareness, but at the same time, I think it's more dangerous because of the messages. And this is going to get far worse before it gets better.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I think it's, worse, I don't know. But I think it's a terrible time. And I think race relations are deteriorating. You know why? Because the identitarian left pushes segregation, de facto segregation. From Brown v. Board to the Civil Rights Act and beyond, it was about integration and repudiation of institutions that segregated people and treated people differently, and one better than the other in terms of differently, obviously, under the color of law. It was a corruption of the law and thus of our culture and our society. And now, we wanted to integrate. We wanted to, those girls in Little Rock to go to school. And now you have grade school classrooms that are segregating by race voluntarily, that this is enlightenment, according to the left. You have, blacks only faculty meetings and whites only faculty meetings and so on, and as well as student assemblies and so forth. So now you're doing it voluntarily. You're promoting, as sort of a cultural norm, racial segregation. And you think that's going to lead us to a better place? Of course it isn't. Michael on the South Side.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. I made the mistake of watching the Sunday talk shows yesterday, and on Meet the Press, my jaw hit the floor when I saw Al Sharpton, of all people, discussing hate in this country.
Right. Right. Well, there you go.
Be kidding.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Right. Right. Talk about somebody who has blood on their hands. Crown Height Sharpton.
Feel guilty about it.
Crown Heights Sharpton.
Yeah, you're right.
Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing this morning? The thing to remember here, two things. You pass a law, and the left thinks you pass a law and everything's taken care of. They never follow up with the enforcement. You know, this kid, it should have been very easy to flag his you know, I don't know how where they've checked for the federal ID, so that he wouldn't get be able to buy a gun going through the federal check service. Secondly, the politicians, like you said, they start talking about this like it's a disease, or, oh, we only have to educate. They have to realize evil exists, and sometimes it's just pure evil. From what I've seen of this, and I'm not trying to make a final judgment here by any stretch, this kid was just pure evil. He's
mentally ill.
Co-opted by evil, and that happens, and you have to realize that. So you can't, the government is hardly ever going to, the law does not stop people from doing things. The law only gives you an ability to arrest them and charge them after they've done what they've done. So,
thanks for the call, Will. Well,
we have gun laws on the books. Do you think they follow any of them? We had a gun ban in Chicago for 25 years, one year we were the murder capital of the world.
Right. Well, and the other question, too, and we don't know the answer to this, is the existence of family, the knowledge that the parents or grandparents or whoever had guardianship of this guy, at least until he was no longer a minor, what was their understanding? What should have been their understanding? Mm-hmm. What, if anything, did they do in talking with school authorities and law enforcement, particularly since he was flagged and there was a state police investigation and he was referred to mental health counseling? So we'll continue to look for answers to those questions and provide them to inform our discussion as they are available. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mike Scott just gave the weather report in Aurora. How about the political climate report? On Friday, WTTW, Wilmette talking to Winnetka.com, posted a story about one Republican, in quotation marks, gubernatorial candidate Richard Irvin, who is the mayor of Aurora. He's the Ken Griffin-funded ventriloquist dummy that they've put up.
He's a flim-flam man, folks.
The story is about text messages, a text exchange from 2018 between Irvin and a former city employee who apparently he was friendly with until a couple of years ago. This is the story reporting. WTTW verified the text messages with the former city of Aurora employee with his phone. And Richard Irvin gave the sort of fork-tongued response you'd expect from a ventriloquist dummy of the GOP establishment in Illinois.
The flim-flam man.
Here are the texts.
Okay. Oh, we're going to do a dramatic reading?
No, it's not enough. Okay. No. No.
Darn it.
And I hate Trump, too. He's an idiot and a bigoted racist, said Richard Irvin. They also had an exchange about whether or not to have a gay pride parade in Aurora, which Irvin was a proponent and this former Aurora employee was not. And but before we get to that, Trump is an idiot. And I hate Trump, too. He's an idiot and a bigoted racist. This is in 2018. Does that inform your perspective on Richard Irvin and whether or not he will receive your vote on June 28th or as soon as May 19th when early voting begins? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Doesn't surprise me. I'm just...
Why doesn't it surprise you?
Because he's not a Republican. He seems like a Trump hater. He never... Even when... Mm-hmm. They had said he was a Republican when he ran for mayor of Aurora. I'm like, I don't think so. And his actions since then, I mean, snuggling up to JB, honoring him, praising him. Picture, you know, Dr. Enzike Day in Aurora, October 28th of last year. I mean, it's just...
Praising Joe Biden. Joe Biden upon his election, his historic election.
Why is it historic? Oh, because there's a black female vice president on the ticket?
Right.
I mean, what made it so historic, Mr. Irvin?
Mm-hmm.
He supports Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
Let his city burn to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Implemented mask mandates. One of their mayors in surrounding areas said, no, I'm not going to enforce them. He didn't do that. He went right along with the Democratic Party the entire time because he is a Democrat, folks.
Well, somebody who's voted in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries, normally you would consider that a Democrat.
It's true.
When it comes to combined Republicans in Illinois, they consider that a conservative. That's apparently what they believe. Vote in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries, support Black Lives Matter, oppose President Trump, and
call him a bigot and a racist right now, which we don't need that right now.
Praise your good friend and a great, compassionate leader of the state of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, and enthusiastically embrace his COVIDian restrictions, lockdowns, masks, vax requirements, and the like. That's what the GOP establishment, such as this, that's what they call a conservative. Think about that, though. Think about what that statement means in the time that he made it before we get to the LGBTQ stuff. I hate Trump, too. He's an idiot and a bigoted racist. By the way, bigoted racist is a little redundant, but I know.
But he was really angry.
He's not that much of a wordsmith. I know he's not great with words when he uses them, which is sparingly in this race.
If you can find him.
We talked about this because I raised it a little bit on Friday night at Jeannie Ives' Breakthrough Ideas dinner, where John, Cass, and I and Jeannie had a little roundtable discussion on Illinois politics and... Obviously, a lot of that was about the governor's race. I hate Trump, too. He's an idiot and a bigoted racist. In 2018, 2 years into his term, a couple things on that. One is it represents a complete misunderstanding or lack of understanding of what transpired. Rather than focusing on the revolt that brought Trump into office, and by 2018, the throwdown he was having with the leftist-controlled institutions of media and Hollywood and the swamp inside the Beltway. He just repeats an MSNBC talking point. That's somebody who is either completely thoughtless or completely clueless, or some combination of the two. And, you know, we talked about this during his presidency, too. You know, just can you pinpoint for us where Trump became a racist? And a bigoted one at that, according to Richard Irvin. Can you pinpoint for us? I mean, I don't want to make this about rehashing Trump, but it's just so lazy intellectually to make that sort of statement, knowing everything you should have known by 2018. So lazy. When did he become a racist? The guy that was being feted by Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push in the 80s, who was a fixture on Oprah, who was being solicited for and giving money to Democrats, congressional Democrats, for all of his adult life. When he rolls around at the age of whatever it was, 68, and runs for presidency, all of a sudden he became a racist. Right. Real convincing. Because why? Because he wanted to secure the border. He wanted to build a wall because of his imprecise language sometimes.
Well, he's a bombastic New York businessman. What do you expect?
And he was a bombastic New York businessman for his entire life, right, up until the point he ran for presidency. My point, it's so lazy intellectually to repeat that, but it's indicative of the mind of whoever would do that. He's an idiot and a bigoted racist, too. Uh-huh. Right.
And okay. He wants to be your Republican governor of Illinois.
I mean, and the second piece of this is Irvin is spending, or it's being spent on his behalf, tens of millions of dollars of Ken Griffin's money telling you that, for example, Darren Bailey wasn't, who is a 2020 Trump delegate, wasn't enough of a Trump supporter. I mean, you know,
I know you can't.
The level of dishonesty of that campaign and those people behind that campaign.
It's unlike anything I've ever seen, Dan.
Well, except from 2018 when they were doing the same thing to Jeannie Ives. And the point is, that cannot go unpunished.
Jeannie Ives, Mike Madigan's favorite.
That cannot be rewarded. If you reward this kind of campaign and this kind of person, then don't complain to anyone about Illinois being the worst governed state in American history, about the need to get out of Illinois because, oh, these policies. When you have a chance, as you did, as we did, we did in 2018, to finally chart a different course for the Republican Party in this state, and you don't take it, well, then that's the bed you've made. And here again, by the grace of God, we have another chance. I don't think we deserve it, but we have another chance. With the same scam artist running the exact same scam, it's actually even worse this time.
Oh, it's worse. So
are you going to reward this again? I want someone to make an argument for Richard Irvin. No one will.
He can't even make an argument for Richard Irvin.
Everyone just does this because the only argument is, I want Ken Griffin's money. That's why people are supporting it. Or people are just as lazy intellectually as Richard Irvin is, and they just think Ken Griffin's money equals victory. Ken Griffin's money plus black guy equals our best chance against Pritzker. So you're either completely ignorant of Illinois politics and the political landscape, and politics just generally. And you're lazy intellectually. I don't know, the guy with the most money. That's what we should do, because he's up against a billionaire. It's either that, or you're just flacking because you want the money. You want to stay in Ken Griffin's good graces someday so that when you can pursue your ambitions, he's there for you. Let me tell you something. You know, Ken Griffin's perspective on this may change depending on the outcome of the primary in terms of who was flacking for who, and in terms of who was leading him down a primrose path with this fatally flawed candidate named Richard Irvin. he may actually engage and look around and say, what the hell did you guys do with my $45 million? This is the best you could do? This is what I was supposed to put $45 million up to do, and for this candidate to back? Maybe he'll – I don't know what he'll say if Richard Ervin doesn't come in, but maybe he'll say that. And so maybe all of the toadies out there who are singing for their supper with hopefully Ken Griffin picking up the tab, maybe they'll regret that they did so. Maybe, maybe not.
So do you think they signed that letter of endorsement for Richard Ervin because they hopefully will get something down the road from Ken Griffin?
It's a mixed bag of like I just
– and everybody.
It's a mixed bag. I mean, these are the combined Republicans in the state are the worst welfare queens on the planet. They don't want to do any work. They don't want to take any risks. They just want to protect their sinecure. Who's ever writing the biggest check? That's where I'll be. They're complete and utter poltroons, in addition to being just existentially lazy. But regardless of what happens to Ervin and whatever Ken Griffin's perspective is on whatever transpires, or I'm sorry, I should say Ervin supporters and whatever his perspective is, again, I don't think I can put this strongly enough. If you reward this campaign, then you are a party to the destruction of Illinois, period. Bill on the Northwest Side.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. What I was going to say is that what really needs to happen is there needs to be a big red wave across the whole nation in November, and the Republican Party in Illinois needs to get crushed. And maybe, just maybe, they might get the message.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Teresa, Gold Coast.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I hope the five Republicans who live in Chicago will do their homework and understand who Ervin is, what he truly represents, and not just see an R after his name on the ballot. He's a Democrat. That's what he is.
Thanks for the call, Teresa. Something else in the text messages I want to get to, I mentioned. The LGBTQ stuff.
Yeah.
By the way, before we get to that, Ervin's statement to WTTW about the story. I don't recall sending those text messages.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right.
Well, I don't recall some text messages, but then when you look at the text message, you have to recall it because it's true.
Mm-hmm. And then he does.
Because if it was a lie, he'd come out and say that. I didn't say that. That's, you know, false information.
I don't recall. I mean, that's right. With the weasel words of the political hack. I don't recall.
It's deposition stuff.
He had this exchange with this employee whose text messages were disclosed about whether or not to have the gay pride parade that he ultimately had in Aurora, whether or not to have it. He said, we have to be fair to everyone. As I've told others, if you don't like the idea of a parade, don't come see it. I don't like musicals, so I don't go see them. As simple as that. As far as listening to your constituents, I am. The majority say it's fair, and there aren't many LGBT in the constituency.
There are many, yeah.
Okay. There are many, yeah, LGBTQ in the constituency. The former employee who he's texting with says, my worldview is based on my upbringing and the word of God and not what's popular in the world today. In my world, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. To which Ervin responds, well said, brother. I can appreciate your worldview. I don't think your view is wrong at all. As a matter of fact, I tend to agree with you personally. However, when a worldview is challenged by a fundamental right of fairness and equity, the latter must win. There was a worldview once that human servitude was acceptable. Although I may not understand Adam and Steve, I have to recognize their fundamental right to exist. The typical hack politician trying to middle the issue and have it both ways, talking about Richard Ervin. He's also a lawyer, and apparently he's not a very good one, even though he's a prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney. I certainly wouldn't want him representing me if prison was on the line. I have to recognize their fundamental right to exist, Adam and Steve. you know, the metaphorical. So here's the thing about that. The maybe out of ignorance, or maybe it's out of duplicity, to misrepresent the position. Is there anyone who says that a gay person or anybody in the LGBTQIA plus community, is there anybody that says they don't have a right to exist? No, there isn't. No. Mm-mm. And fundamental right to fairness and equity. I don't know where that is found in the Constitution. Well, I do. It's not. So I don't even know what he's talking about. He's just sort of talking out of his ass and using flowery language to pretend that he's, you know, real kind of sensitive, and he's you know, balancing competing interests in a thoughtful way. He's doing none of it. Fundamental right to fairness and equity, fundamental right to exist, and so on and so forth. Can I just say something about this?
Yeah.
Pro-LGBTQ rights, anti-LGBTQ rights. There is no anti-LGBTQ rights. There's nobody that's anti-LGBTQ rights. I mean, virtually nobody. There's no movement. There's no party that's anti-LGBTQ rights. They're not conservatives, like, you know, thoughtful conservatives, serious people, who are anti-rights for people who are in the LGBTQIA+. That does not exist. I'm not against rights for a gay person or a trans person. They have the same rights, from my perspective, per natural law, as enshrined in the Constitution, that I have. The exact same rights. No less, and importantly, here's the rub, no more. There is no difference, and should be no difference, before, I know there's no difference before God. There's no difference, should be no difference before the law, as informed by the Constitution, between me and somebody in the LGBTQIA community, in terms of our rights. Zero. You understand? That is a bastardization and a misrepresentation of the position of conservatives who don't want to be forced to celebrate things they find morally objectionable. That has nothing to do with rights. And it's sloppy language. Purposely by the D.C. press corps, and I don't know, purposely or not, by certain hack politicians. Some purposely, some they're just so dumb and thoughtless, they just repeat whatever is emanating from CNN or MSNBC, like Richard Irvin. Mike in Big Rock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Mike.
Mike.
Hello. Yes. This is Mike. You know, I wanted to say, I think if we have a strong, unapologetically conservative and strong, we can win this thing, because I do believe that Pritzker's support is soft. I think he's turned off a lot of people, and we can win. But with Irvin, we're not going to have a chance.
Thanks for the call, Mike. I agree with you. Everything about Jelly Belly is soft.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So over the weekend, there was the Old Parkland Conference in Dallas, which was a lineup of conservative thought leaders to talk about the issues of the day. The focus, it appears, was really the social and economic situation of Black Americans. That was the focus of the conversation. It was certainly in part, it was part of the discussion, I should say, that Clarence Thomas, Supreme Court Justice Thomas, had with John Yoo, who was a fellow Yale University Law School grad. Yoo is also a professor of law at Berkeley. He was in the Bush Justice Department, W. And there was a lot to discuss, and since you don't get Clarence Thomas to speak at length too often, it's worth listening to some of what he had to say, as one of the most consequential jurists of our lifetime, as well as one of the more consequential conservative intellects of the last 50 years. Justice Thomas on the Dobbs leak, the leak of the Dobbs draft opinion, and its import, what it means.
If someone said that one line of one opinion would be leaked by anyone, and you would say, that, oh, that's impossible. No one would ever do that. There's such a belief in the rule of law, a belief in the court, a belief in what we were doing, that that was verboten. It was beyond anyone's understanding, or at least anyone's imagination, that someone would do that. And look where we are, where now that trust or that belief is gone forever. And when you lose that trust, especially in the institution that I'm in, it changes the institution fundamentally. You begin to look over your shoulder. It's like kind of an infidelity that you can explain it, but you can't undo it. What happened at the court is tremendously bad. I think it's, I wonder how long we're going to have these institutions at the rate we're undermining them. And then I wonder when they're gone or they are destabilized, what we will have as a country. And I don't think that the prospects are good if we continue to lose them.
Mm-hmm. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. I like that comparison. It's the leak is to an infidelity. You know, you can't, you can...
forgive but never forget.
Yeah, sort of, basically, yeah.
Want to put it in girls' terms for you?
Well, I mean, and so, yeah, and the infidelity of the institution, the implications, and of course he asks the right question for consideration. Okay, we're going to watch as these institutions are gutted from the inside out by the left. What do you think replaces it? Something better? Who's doing the gutting? Right. You think it's going to be better than what it was? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. He also recounted a recent visit to University of Georgia in his home state. And talking to the students at UGA.
This is University of Georgia. I said, how many of you can take a view on this campus of traditional families? And, of course, nobody. Oh, you got a lot of people staring at the floor. How many of you can take a pro-life position on this campus, staring at the floor? And as you go on and on. You take positions that are obviously at odds with the current mood on these campuses. Now, this is where you learn how to deal with views that are different. Now, if you don't learn at that point, the law schools are just as bad now. At John's alma mater, Yale, they just...
Did you give your degree back again?
Yale does not recognize.
Me either.
Okay. Oh, so we're in the same boat. But they just protested a group and made it very difficult for others to come and certainly had a chilling effect. Now, Yale was, when I was there visiting, it was anything goes. As you do your thing, I do my thing. And maybe too much of that. But it certainly wasn't prior restraint, and it certainly wasn't censorship. But here we are, where that's acceptable at one of the elite universities. And it's pretty much acceptable at all the universities. And if we're there with these institutions, how do we recover?
How do we recover? How do we recover? Talking about Yale, I mean, I think you is probably in his late 50s. Thomas is obviously 70. And what Yale was when they were there versus what Yale is, and as Justice Thomas said, virtually every college is and law school is today. how do we recover if you don't learn how to debate, you don't learn how to tolerate divergent viewpoints on particular issues. I thought that you know, his point about asking UGA students what the positions they're allowed or right. not allowed to take on campus is a key example of what's happened. And so go back again to say these institutions that have been gutted from the inside out, academia, that's a pretty good indication of or a pretty good example of answering the, well, then what happens next after they're gutted? Well, look at where the universities and the law schools were back when Thomas or John Yoo were at Yale. By the way, black man, Asian man.
Right.
Yeah, but that diversity doesn't matter because they're conservative and originalists. But anyway, look at where they were, what the school was like a couple of generations ago and what it is today. That gives you the trajectory of institutions that are gutted from the inside out by the left, doesn't it? How do we recover? I mean, certainly you could use a few more Clarence Thomases in positions of authority, and I'm not just limiting that to the Supreme Court. Let me give you an example of what I do mean, the kind of leadership you could get in these institutions if you're willing to fight and if you're willing to be who you were when you came to the institution, regardless of the personal or political costs to be who you were when you came to the institution, which is really the example that Thomas has set, hasn't he? Here's Thomas sharing an anecdote about a law clerk that he hired because the question was asked, you know, what's the talent pool like for law clerks? Is it still robust given what you're saying about the state of affairs in American law schools?
Her achievement, the way that we choose, we are actually inundated with talent. I had a young woman, and I'm not going to tell you her name. I interviewed her. And I'm not going to give you any of her particulars because I don't want anybody bothering her. But she walks into my office. We have a long process, screening process, to hire law clerks because there's so few of them, so few that you hire. And she comes into my office after many rounds of screening, and it was the first time I realized she was black. No one, it was so irrelevant in our process that no one had bothered to mention that she was black. And I remember telling the clerks to tell her that. I said, wow, that's interesting. I didn't know she was black. But she made it through. And then when she was told that, what do you think she felt? She was delighted. Yeah. Because she knew that played no role in her achievements, that her achievements were hers. And, you know, but there's no problem.
Mm-hmm. That's a different way to do things, the way we're doing them from K through college in corporate America, even in the arts now. It's a different way to do them, the way that Clarence Thomas does them in his own office as a Supreme Court justice. Maybe that's the way we recover. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and she's finally gone, Amy. Finally, Jen Psaki done.
Do over. You're going to have to go do it and mean it this time, man.
I ran out of juice because of all the time she said she was leaving when she wasn't.
3 weeks. 3 weeks
finally,
we waited for this victorious moment to happen.
Finally, on Friday, it came.
I thought I wasn't going to get emotional. Okay. Thank you. I want to say thank you to the president and the first lady. They entrusted me in serving this role for the last 15 months. I'm not going to cry about the press team. Whew. Okay.
Yeah, me neither.
Thank you to the press team. Many of them are here. Some of them are not here because they are taking much needed days off. It has nothing to do with me personally, I promise. But
I read into it.
A lot of them. For those who don't know them, they are incredibly tough, smart, hardworking, and deeply, deeply good human beings, deeply good public servants. And, you know, people always ask me, and I'm sure you guys get asked this too, about whether Washington is rotten, you know, whether everybody is corrupt here and, you know, nothing good happens and we all just argue with each other. And I, having done this job, believe the absolute opposite is true, because I have worked with and engaged with all of these incredible people across the administration and this amazing team, many of whom are here that I get to work with every day.
Yeah. Well, whatever Jennifer Psaki believes, I believe the opposite. So, and I don't want to, you know, I said I wasn't going to, you know, go with the waterworks on this. So let me just try to keep this together. Uh-huh. I thought Kyle Smith at the New York Post had a nice send off. As White House press secretary, you were indeed very informative. Every day you provide an example of how today's Democratic Party turns normie soccer moms from Greenwich into reality-denying attack machines, sputtering insults and cheering on lawbreakers because they can't face up to the unpopularity of their far-left agenda.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a nice hat to Jen Psaki. I don't think it's inaccurate. We won't miss her. Yeah, but we will be able to distinguish her from Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow, which I can't do for those two alone.
Yes.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Blake Masters is a venture capitalist. He was a associate of Peter Thiel's, also the co-author of Zero to One, which is must read if you're interested in entrepreneurship or just the way the minds of very successful entrepreneurs like Thiel and Masters work. Blake Masters is a Republican candidate for Senate in Arizona, looking to take out Mark Kelly, the incumbent there, pick up opportunity for Senate Republicans. This was his take on the $40 billion in aid to Ukraine pending in the Senate last week. Not dissimilar, maybe a little bit more pointed even, but not dissimilar to the position J.D. Vance took, the Republican nominee for Senate in Ohio now. And one wonders if this doesn't represent the burgeoning America First position that is presenting itself in elections around the country.
Well, the House of Representatives just greenlit $40 billion for Ukraine. $40 billion. But remember, they said $8 billion for a border wall with Mexico was too expensive. Under Joe Biden, it's always America last. Now, let's be clear about what this means. It means no ceasefire. It means another foreign war where we pay for everything. Many more thousands of people will die. There's no resolution, no end in sight. And the risk, of course, is that a proxy war can escalate into an all-out nuclear war between nuclear powers. If our leaders were serious people who cared about this country, they'd urge peace abroad and they'd crack down on violence here at home. But they're buffoons who hate you. So instead, they'll keep defending Ukraine's borders while turning their backs on ours. They'll keep funding killing in Eastern Europe and tolerating it in Chicago. So look, we've got our own problems. Our economy is on life support. But apparently there's always more money for waging proxy wars halfway around the world.
Nice to get a Chicago shout-out from Arizona,
Amy?
Thanks. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you think violence, we would like you to think Chicago. Thank you.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not fair to make those comparisons, and you have to look at what our geopolitical and national security interests are in Eastern Europe, sans bad public policy decisions with respect to securing the southern border or providing for peace on the streets of America's cities. But you can understand why it has people frustrated, particularly when representatives of the Democrat Socialist Party continue to tell us that we're at war, even though no such declaration has been offered, other than by people like Seth Moulton from Massachusetts and Steny Hoyer, who's in leadership, you know.
But we're at war. We need to produce energy. As I told you, in Cove Point is now sending 80%, reversing Asia supply to European supply because they need it because we're at war. Biden does want a clean environment. Biden does want us to look at alternative energy. That's what he was talking about in the campaign, that he wanted to look to that. But President Biden has made it very clear he understands in the short term. Short term could be 25 years or 5 years. In the short term, but particularly during the course of this war, we need to have all petroleum products, and we need to have them for ourselves and for our allies. I yield back.
I don't know which part of that statement from Hoyer is more offensive, the declaration that we're at war or the assertion that Joe Biden understands the urgency of our needs and that the bottom line is that fossil fuels are the only fuels that are going to serve those needs in the short term. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano for our weekly conversation, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Wow, that was just two large helpings of word salad.
Yes, well, that's what we do here.
You know,
so, well, start with Blake Masters.
This gets to exactly to the point in which I think your listeners, I think more than any other listeners in the country, because they listen to you, really appreciate, which is people need to think for themselves. And, you know, and the world that we live in is not a buffet table where, like, you can pick the stuff you like and then discard the stuff you don't like. And we have, because all these things impact our freedom and our safety and our prosperity. And we need to deal with all of them, and we need to deal with them in context and realize that they can impact each other. And so I think that the Ukraine bill is a perfect example. Look, I think, first of all, we're not at war in Ukraine, and it's not a proxy war. A proxy war is where you pay somebody to kill other people. We are helping the Ukrainians defend themselves. We're not at war, and it's not a proxy war. That's just the specific reality of where we happen to be in Ukraine. It isn't our interest to do that because – Russia, this was never about Ukraine for Russia. This is about Russia's grand design for Europe, which is also, by the way, China's grand design, which is to isolate and marginalize America and the world. And us doing stuff to prevent them from doing that, that all makes sense. I'm not sure that has anything to do with this legislation that Biden put out there of $40 billion of spending, which is not offset by anything. You know, we wasted, according to the last thing I saw, we wasted $168 billion in COVID spending. That was fraud, theft, and abuse. We wasted $168 billion. And his answer to that was, let's just throw another $40 billion into the kitty.
Well, what did the Ukrainians already do with the $20 billion that we gave them?
Well, I mean, you have to parse exactly what money that is and what things it went for. But the point is we did a sup for $33 billion, and now we're doing a sup for $40 billion. And you know what's missing from all this is, where's the shopping? You know, when you go to the store, right, you have a shopping list. And you make that shopping list based on the stuff you need in your house, right? And that shopping list keeps you from going in the store and just saying, oh, give me a dozen of these or whatever. And where is our shopping list? In other words, where is our strategy, not just for Ukraine, but for how we're going to protect America and the world? This administration kicked a gender strategy out the door almost on day one. But here we are over 2 years, and we don't have a national security strategy. We don't have a defense strategy. We've never had a clear strategy or explanation for what we're doing in Ukraine. And strategies are not just about, okay, how I'm going to do this. A strategy is also a benchmark to determine whether you are spending money efficiently and effectively. You know, when we said in World War II, defeat Germany first, that wasn't just, okay, we're going to go defeat Germany first. That was a signal, will we prioritize everything from, you know, LSTs to where the troops are going, how many tanks we need. It was a guide to make sure that we were spending in accordance with our strategy. We don't have that, and we have a physically irresponsible government. So when people like J.D. Vance and Rand Paul, and who I don't necessarily agree with everything they say on foreign policy, when they say this is completely physically irresponsible, and at some point we got to throw a red flag, I'm with them. I just did a piece on this on Fox News that just spelled this out. I'm for supporting Ukraine. I'm against supporting Ukraine by bankrupting America.
So this $40 billion that's pending in the Senate, you would be opposed to it for that reason?
I would be opposed to the bill because it's not – first of all, anytime Congress says we have to do something right away, that means there's something wrong, right? That we couldn't take time to unpack and parse this bill and have a real debate over it, that bothers me. I'm not sure that all I'm positive all that $40 billion is not justified, and I am really angry that we can throw $40 billion at this, but the administration can't sit down and have a responsible discussion about other national security matters like border security. I'm in the camp that says we can help Ukraine and secure our own border. The reality is if you look at what we're doing on the border, it is costing us more to unsecure the border than to secure the border. I mean, if you look at the money that they have thrown to turn the Department of Homeland Security and all the NGOs who are working with them into the largest human trafficking network in the world, that is costing us way more than it would be to just secure the border and lock it down.
And so what is the argument? I mean, you know, I heard arguments like from Dan Crenshaw that basically says, look, this is an opportunity for us to weaken a mortal enemy of the United States, that being Russia, and do so without endangering American lives. And so that's why we should seize this opportunity. You know, I guess it seems to me the philosophy of those that are sort of open to the idea of writing blank checks, even as imperfectly as these aid packages are, as you're describing, seems to me that basically saying, look, Putin over-rotated. He made a strategic blunder in invading Ukraine and the way he chose to invade them and what his expectations were. He's weakened because of it. This is our opportunity to strike because we can actually, if we provide help to Ukraine, we can actually defeat Putin and we can push the Red Army back to Russia. Is that a fair characterization of what the thinking is? And is it a fair assessment of what the opportunity is?
Well, I don't think it's a fair assessment of what the opportunity is. I actually disagree with people who say, well, this is our chance to beat up and destroy the Russian army. First of all, it's a stupid argument because the reality is Putin can go back and rebuild his army and nobody can stop him. Right? He controls that country and the resources. He can decide where that money goes. He can rebuild his army. So that's an ephemeral gain to just say, oh, well, we're going to weaken the Russian army. Okay, well, big deal, because our goal is not to weaken the Russian army. Our goal is to keep the Russian army on the other side of the blue line. That's our goal. And to me, when people start talking like that, this gets into the overreach thing. And this is where I think you really have to be careful. And this is why you have vital interests, important interests, other interests, and where you allocate resources to match those interests. And you don't exceed your grasp. You know, when we went into Iraq, as misguided as it was, we went in there to protect what we thought was a threat. Having said that, then we decided we were going to, you know, turn Iraq into the land of milk and honey. I mean, this was overreach. I mean, I think we did the same thing in Afghanistan.
But you agree? You agree that people are making the argument that I made. That's what they're saying.
People are making the argument that you make, and I think it's a bad argument. Mm-hmm. I think losing sight of our goal, which is to help Ukrainians defend their territory, because that combats Russian aggression, that is, I think, laudable and appropriate and consistent with our national interests. This notion of somehow, well, we're going to destroy the Russian army so they're never a threat to us again, that's a lie. That's never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. News that's circulating about Putin's health, he has cancer. Now we hear it's maybe blood cancer in his bloodstream, serious form of cancer. Not that all aren't, but you know what I'm saying. And also that because of his weakened state politically as well as physically, there are rumors of a coup attempt afoot.
Yeah. How would we know, right?
I don't know.
This is the problem with closed societies. You know, the people in these societies, often the people in the government, even don't know. So I don't know. I don't have real evidence to make a judgment on that one way or another. I will say, as a strategist, you know, and as a guy in military planner, you never bank on the bank shot, right? You never bank on the Putin dropping dead or getting overthrown, because first of all, you don't know if it's going to happen. Second of all, you don't know if it's going to be better or worse than before. So what you have to do is you plan to safeguard your interests in a responsible manner, and then you take history as it comes.
Now, Finland has moved forward with formal applications for NATO membership. Sweden, we hear, is close to follow. What do you think Putin's response is going to be?
Well, a lot of vitriol, maybe some backstabbing, but he's not going to invade Sweden and Finland. He can barely hang on to Ukraine. So I think the physical threat, I think that's ephemeral. But here's what I would say about Putin. Look, this guy is a thug, and thugs know they are only respected if they are feared. So he's gonna come back if he's still alive, and seek revenge, and seek to hurt people. I mean, you know the Russian argument against the Ukrainians fighting is kind of like the bank robber complaining that they won't let him into the vault. I mean, it's classic blaming the victim. So my point, I think, there's not much Putin can do to stop Finland and Sweden from joining. It's in our interest that they join. It will definitely strengthen our northern flank. And here's the big but is, dude, then you need to get serious about the future, because if that's all you do, Putin's going to come back someday like Jason Voorhees and come at you again. We need to address the energy independence. We need to address strategic and conventional deterrence against Russia. So when he does rebuild, if he's still around, he's not a threat to us in the future.
Provide more detail on that. Sweden and Finland, or Swinland, as I call them, to combine.
Yeah,
Swinland. their entrance into NATO is in our interest. Give us more detail on that.
Right. So if you look at the northern flank of NATO, it's really not defensible without Norway, which is already in NATO, Norway, Finland, and Sweden. Just geographically, you cannot defend the northern flank and the Baltic region without those countries. You know, conversely, if the Russians wanted to seriously invade Europe, they would never respect the neutrality of Sweden and Finland anyway. So it does make for a more secure and defensible NATO, which is in our interest. There are countries that will come in with a significant amount of military capability, which would be valuable to NATO, and it would be more efficient because now they're formally part of NATO. And the one part of this that nobody's talking about, which is actually very important, one area of increasing competition is the Arctic region, not just with Russia, but also with China. And these are all three Arctic countries. And so actually having Norway, Finland, and Sweden all in NATO will actually help a lot in terms of competition with the Chinese and Russians in the Arctic. So on balance, I think there's very low risk to bring them into NATO. They bring in a lot of capability, and it actually puts us in a stronger strategic position. But like I said, you know, we've got to look at these long-term things. You know, not just us. All the NATO partners need to stand up and do their part so we can defend NATO. We have to be energy independent. And if we don't do those things, then we're losing the real opportunity that we've gained by the Russian missteps in Ukraine.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano of the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always.
All right, thank you. Hey, are you guys really in the Matrix? Is that what I heard him say?
We're in the Matrix Home Solutions. Yes, we're in the Matrix. Amy is playing the role
studio of
Neo. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So I want to make sure I heard that right.
Yeah, hey, right.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Talk to you next week.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The big guy was asked about baby formula over the weekend. No, not if you'd like to have some for lunch, but whether or not there's anything the administration can do, should be doing to address the shortage of said.
If we'd been better mind readers, I guess we could have, but we moved as quickly as the problem became apparent to us. And we have to move with caution as well as speed, because we got to make sure what we're getting is in fact first-rate product. That's why the FDA has to go through the process.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff Psaki just, you know, defended sending pallets full of baby formula to the border to help, you know, people who are here illegally before helping American children.
But we believe that when children and babies, or babies, I should say, are crossing the border with a family member, that providing them formula is morally right. And so we certainly support the implementation of it.
Yeah, nobody's opposed to providing babies with formula, Jen. Nice try. It's the issue of availability. It's the issue of scarcity and the prioritization of who is served first. And again, I understand her position because for the Biden administration, there is no difference between an American citizen and somebody who's not an American citizen. There's no difference between somebody who's in this country legally and somebody who's not in this country legally, because in the infamous words of AOC, a person can't be illegal. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Very good. Also, related story on tone deafness. Capitol Hill staffers now are getting access to a Peloton membership that we pay for.
How does that happen? They can download the app and do classes. It's normally $40 a month. They can't fork over $40 a month on their own.
Well, I'm sure that there are many Capitol Hill staffers that could use some time on an exercise bike, but you know, it's one of those things I prefer not to have to pay for. For more on congressional priorities, we're pleased to be joined by our friend Congresswoman Mary Miller. She is from Oakland, Illinois. Amy, do you know where that is?
It's south what of county? I-80.
Yes, it's southern Illinois, which I know to you is south of Taylor Street. That's southern Illinois.
No.
That's where southern Illinois begins.
Not me, other people.
Oakland is in Coles County.
Yes.
Not far from Charleston, the home of?
Eastern Illinois.
Very good.
The Panthers. Right.
You're doing better than about 80% of the people
and
who live north of I-80.
All famous quarterbacks who graduated from there, but I won't.
Mary Miller, Congressman Miller, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning. I'm on my way back to D.C. from what some of us call the garden spot of the world. It's beautiful on the farm. Our seeds are starting to come up. We had a little rain, and it makes you feel hopeful.
Well, so are you getting back there because you have a Peloton class, or why are you going back?
No, I don't have time for exercise when I'm there. But back to Biden's comments, he's a weak and incompetent man, and I give zero credence to what comes out of his mouth. I'm looking at what they're doing, and in every way they're dismantling our country. It is America last in everything. And this baby formula situation, I've kind of known about for a while. I've been trying to sound the alarm. One of our daughters adopted in January an infant, a special needs baby, and she's been telling us for probably 2 months that she's been having trouble getting formula. And in fact, she has a sister and a friend from church that are providing breast milk for her to try to supplement, for her, the baby formula.
But so what is, President Biden just makes these declarative statements. We're doing something about it. What are they doing about it? Are they going to import baby formula? There was talk of importing it from Ireland and Mexico and the Netherlands.
Well, who would really know what they're doing? I don't believe a thing that they say. I can tell you that there's a spirit of deception over this country. They lie without shame out there. And I'm sorry to tell people that, but it's the truth. You know, I do think, I believe Buttigieg came out and said that we have four manufacturers producing 90% of the baby formula, and that's not a healthy situation. I think some of these supply chain crises are highlighting that we need to change the way we do life. I mean, I do know also, just of course, we raise beef, and we know that 80 to 90% of the protein processing in our country is done by four manufacturers or four processors also. And so we need to look at how we are bringing products to the American consumers and make, it's not a free market if if it's controlled by three or four manufacturers or processors.
Well, yeah, perhaps. I mean, though it's, you know, oligopoly is tough to exist without government protection. But it seems to me that Biden is doing on this issue what he's done on the energy issue. He's blaming oil and gas companies for the energy prices. He's blaming the baby formula manufacturers like Abbott for this baby formula shortage. When in point of fact, don't we understand that Abbott was the subject of an extended FDA investigation after a recall because there was some suspicion that the baby formula from Abbott had caused some illness in a handful of children? And they were cleared. But part of the story is a regulatory story, which is the FDA took years to get this investigation done, taking that manufacturing facility offline. And now, as we expected coming out of the pandemic, you think, oh, well, these companies just flip a switch and everything's back to full production and normal. And it doesn't work that way.
Right. Yes, they did close that manufacturing facility. And I believe they produce or provide 15% of the formula. And yes, we are limiting or have been limiting imports, and every other country in the world can get formula. So this is one situation, but the bureaucratic red tape in our country it's insane. It's hurting Americans.
And here again, just sticking on the topic of food and thinking about it globally, but including the United States, word over the weekend is that India, which is the second largest wheat producer in the world, is halting wheat exports because of fears of both scarcity.
Themselves.
Well, yeah, some of that is. I think this is informed by what's happening in Ukraine as well. So we're talking about, again, the potential of a global famine or many millions more people that are on the brink of starvation than are normally on an annualized basis. And usually the United States is the country that provides leadership in trying to prevent famine. So we've got sort of a global food crisis on our hands in addition to some domestic ones.
Yes, and I can tell you because living is it's essential that we have fertilizer. And, you know, I brought this up in the Ag Committee, and the answer was that we should use less. But a lot of this does go back to shutting down our gas and oil production. I mean, even the war between Russia and Ukraine, I'm sorry, but we're funding both sides of the war. As long as our gas and oil production is not up, we are enriching Putin. We have allowed Putin to have the money to proceed with this invasion. And now we even had a farmer call us from Western Illinois, and I haven't actually checked this out, but he said that they're trying to limit the amount of diesel that they can get at a time. I know we need to fill up our diesel tanks, and it's extremely painful, but this gas and oil shutdown is going to bring us to our knees.
I wanted to get to your viewpoint on sort of for lack of a better description, the culture wars that are ongoing on the issue of life after the draft opinion of Dobbs was leaked, on the issue of the pronoun Stasi in the K-12 school systems that we're seeing play out, you know, across the board. It's just another aspect of what the situation is at K-12. And your posture on those issues as a conservative leader in the House Republican caucus and what you think and where you think the Republican Party needs to be on them.
Well, the Republican Party that I can see is we're 100% pro-life. We 100% oppose taxpayer dollars funding abortion. We want the issues to go back to the states. These leftist wackos are deliberately misrepresenting the impact of the Supreme Court decision. And so that's, you know, on the pro-life issue. Then we've got the transgendering children issue, which, first of all, the abortion issue, they lied to the women. Now the transgender issue, they're lying to the children. They're trying to put in their heads that you can actually change your sex, which we all know is impossible. It's insanity. But they're telling kids that these chemical drugs or the chemicals that they're taking that will halt puberty or whatever, chemical castration, telling them that it's reversible.
Well, right. And so now give us that answer in the context of this primary campaign you have against another incumbent. You're drawn together with Rodney Davis, who's an incumbent yes. Republican congressman,
right.
And because of the remap. And so what is the choice for Southern Illinois voters and Central Illinois voters yes. to some extent in
okay.
this race
well,
between you and Davis?
President Trump endorsed me because I'm 100% always have been America First supporter, and not only I've walked the talk. All of our children are 100% America First Trump supporters. President Trump endorsed me because we share the same priorities, which is strong military, securing our border, energy independence, two-way peace through strength. But also on the social issues, it's one thing to make a pro-life vote. It's another thing to be leading on the issue. For example, I just introduced a bill called Protecting Life on College Campuses Act. And what it does is it prohibits federal funding to any college or university that's providing chemical abortion services, either directly or indirectly, to the students. They prey on these young women. They don't tell them the truth. And this is do-it-yourself, at-home abortion. It's very dangerous.
If you and Rodney, are you going to have a debate?
Well, I would love to have a debate with them. I don't know. We have different. We did have. We had something in Adams County at Quincy. Mm-hmm. We each introduced ourselves, and after everybody realized that Rodney shagged out. So I don't know if he'll actually show up or not.
You remember?
I have 100% conservative rating with the American Conservative Union, and he has an F. That might be why he wants to leave. And all I care about is people's voting record and the direction they're taking our country. The other thing is, I belong to the Freedom Caucus, a conservative constitutional group. Mm-hmm. I belong to the Border Caucus, to the Pro-Life Caucus. I don't know where he is. I never see him at any of these things, at the pro-life things. I've been a strong advocate for parental rights, speaking up even before the school board issues in Virginia.
She is Representative Mary Miller. She's running for re-election. She's got a June 28th primary, as you heard, against another incumbent, Rodney Davis. And Representative Miller, where can people get more information about your campaign and candidacy?
They can go to marymiller.gov.com or Mary Miller for Congress.
All right, so Mary Miller for Congress is the political website. MaryMiller.gov, .house.gov is for all of your governmental work, right? Okay, very
yeah.
good. Representative Miller, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, talk about giving a guy a platform. On Sunday night, that would be last night.
Yeah.
Probably didn't see this because this is a network and a program in particular that probably has fewer viewers than the Billboard Music Awards. Tony Fauci was on with Jim Acosta. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
He used to be somebody. Yeah.
No, he's going to make it as an anchor. I'm too good for street reporting and being a White House correspondent. I'm going to get in the big chair. And how has he been doing?
Oh, I don't know. But he did have Tony Fauci on because that's about where Tony Fauci is right now. He's got to defile himself by going on Jim Acosta's show on CNN for people to see. And here's their exchange about Tony Fauci's future.
Yeah.
Thinking
we can
about
get him
it
out.
In an electoral context.
If Trump were to return to the White House as president, and COVID is still a threat, or there's some other public health emergency, would you have confidence in his ability? Would you have confidence in his ability to deal with a pandemic of this nature? Would you want to stay on in your post?
Well, no, to the second question. The first question.
Well, there's an easy platform. I mean, I know Ultra MAGA is prevailing right now, but hire me or rehire me, fire Fauci.
That might work. I mean, and then at the end of the conversation, he said, so if president's elected, if Trump comes back to the Oval Office, will you leave? And he said, yes. So I mean,
that's T-shirt material.
There you go.
That's a hat. That's a mug. Rehire Trump and fire Fauci. I got a better idea, though.
What?
Under a President DeSantis appoints Trump to head the CDC. And then everybody quits. And we start over. For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
It has. You recently, for City Journal, wrote about DeSantis, the left's, one of the left's boogeymen. There's several, including the MAGA king, as we know him now. Your distillation of the left's approach to DeSantis, and if you would, compare and contrast how the media takes on a DeSantis as compared and contrasted to how they take on a Trump.
Well, I argued in the piece, and I detailed, you know, bit by bit why I feel this way, but I think that DeSantis is emerging as the left's number one boogeyman at this point. And I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. And I would say, too, it's interesting because it's not just DeSantis, but it's our entire state. It's really all of us that the left hates at this moment. Even just the mere mention of Florida, they just start to freak out.
Yeah, so, until they vacation.
Until they vacation, I was going to say that.
Until they vacation go there. But just the mere mention of Florida, they start getting angry. But I think that they're really concerned about Ron DeSantis, to be honest with you. My personal viewpoint is that I think that the left would prefer to have a Trump get the nomination, DeSantis. In their eyes, I think they'd use DeSantis as the greater threat, particularly because he's very action-oriented. He's very focused on legislation. Doesn't spend a lot of time on Twitter feuds and doing a lot of other frivolous stuff. He gets a lot of legislation passed, and of course he's aided in that effort by the fact that we have a substantial majority of Republicans in the House here.
Well, how do you think the nation...
Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
Well, how do you think the nation, the rest of the country is going to view and still is viewing the mislabeled Don't Say Gay bill?
Yeah. That's another one. So I think that the polls have already shown that something like two-thirds of Americans are actually okay with the parental rights and education bill that the media has mislabeled Don't Say Gay. So I think you know, the media understands that at one level and is concerned about it. That's why they've distorted it to such a degree. And I think if you look at parents, when you drill down further to asking parents, people who have children in of school age, how do you feel about the parental rights and education bill, once people actually know what's in it, it's something like 70% support it, 70-75% support it. So, and I think that that's what scares the left. That's what scares the left about Ron DeSantis, is actually that his ideas, most of them are actually quite popular. I mean, here in, you know, as I explained in the piece, he's expanded the Democratic majority here. When he came into office, the Democrats had a substantial registration advantage, and now the Republicans do. And he's winning over independents here big time. I think he's even winning over some Democrats. And when he wins in November by 8 or 10 points, which is about what the polling average is at the moment, the left is just going to absolutely freak out, because Florida's been a 50-50 state for a very long time. So to watch a Republican win, as I think he will, with, let's say, 57, 58, 59% of the vote, it's going to be – I don't know how they're going to cope with that. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough for them.
So going back to what I said, how the media approaches Trump versus how they approach DeSantis.
Oh, sorry. Right. So I think that how they approach them is similar in a way. I don't know if you would agree with this, but I think the character assassination is similar. But I think that it comes from two very different sort of angles. So with Trump, they would focus on personality issues, obviously his tweets, things of that nature. And I think with DeSantis, what they've had to do is actually distort statistics and numbers and what's actually in legislation, because he doesn't spend a lot of time feuding with people and such. So, for example, as I argued in the piece, the media continues to distort COVID statistics, COVID death rates, and try to make it seem as though our state performed poorly with respect to COVID mortality rates. And the key way that they do this is by not adjusting for age. So as everybody knows, Florida's the second oldest state in the country. And not only that, but we also have a tremendous elderly population that comes here in the wintertime for a week, a month, 3 weeks, a season, whatever, that don't reflect those statistics. And so if you adjust for age, our death rate, our per capita death rate is 32nd in the country out of the 50 states. Very similar. I looked at it this morning. Very similar to Illinois, actually. Almost statistically exactly the same as Illinois. Illinois is actually 35th, but we had 274 deaths per 100,000 people, and Illinois had 271. And if you adjust that for age and the fact that we're an elderly population, we're performing far better than average. But the media won't go there. They won't adjust for age. They want to try to pretend like Florida is the same as California demographically and every other state, when in fact it isn't. So right. I think that's the key difference.
Well, it seems to, you know, they don't have a lot of tools in their toolbox, to use a favorite phrase of theirs. They've got two blunt instruments: idiot, evil. They apply both to Trump because of his bombast and so forth. They apply, but they can't apply to both to DeSantis. They can only apply evil. And so that's what they try to do. They're going to make him out to be evil. Don't say gay. He's a bigot. He's mean-spirited, so on and so forth. The other problem they have with DeSantis is, and this goes to the bombast sort of the personality, there are arguments that DeSantis offers. There's granular knowledge of the policy being discussed that he possesses, and it dwarfs anything that the press corps covering him, national or regional, possesses. And so the ability to make quality arguments to defend your position while you're also decimating your opponent's position, because your opponent, generally speaking, knows so little, and I'm specifically talking about the press, but I'm not limiting it to the press, of course. That's a big difference between DeSantis and Trump. It is a constructive criticism of Trump in a sense, but it's also just highlights a personality and policy focus, personality difference and a policy focus difference that distinguishes DeSantis from Trump and makes him much more difficult for the press to deal with. And thus, I think, to your conclusion, much more dangerous for the left.
Yeah, and I think those are very good points. I think also, too, in the way the two men respond to the media is also very different. Trump, for some reason, I don't know if he still does, but at least during his presidency, he still somehow craved the approval of some of these liberal media outlets. He'd grant interviews to liberal outlets, and you're thinking, what is he thinking? Clearly, they're going to, you know, it seemed like, whereas DeSantis won't do things like that. I mean, he knows when he's being set up to fail, he's not going to give an interview to CNN. I mean, maybe he would, but it's mostly a waste of time. So I don't think he needs their approval. I think he understands that they're not going to treat him fairly, and it's sort of pointless to even engage with them on that level. So I think that the two men approach the media in a different way too. And I still don't understand why Trump gives interviews to some of the outlets he does. Actually, he's kind of cooled off on that as an ex-president, but during his presidency, it seemed like he somehow felt like maybe he could win over the New York Times, you know? Didn't you feel that way, that Trump somehow naively felt that he could somehow win over some of these outlets? And what are you thinking? You're not going to win them over.
I couldn't figure out it. I mean, I think it's a combination of the two. I think you're right. There's an element of that. And then there's an element of just loving the combativeness of it, which I actually like about Trump. I like seeing people that want to stand and deliver and fight their opponents straight away, you know, face to face. I respect that. And I think DeSantis would do the same, too, on a debate stage or in the political or policy arena. But yeah, I think there was an element of that too, thinking it could win them over, being a little bit, I used to have a good relationship. I used to be able to, I see these people at cocktail parties. They're not going to be too bad. And of course, interests were no longer aligned. So they were terrible. And, you're right about that. Something else though, on DeSantis, I wanted to get to is, much like Trump, but in a different way, he does a good job of getting the left to expose themselves, and he changes their behavior in so doing. And this Disney matter is a perfect example. So the combination of what he did to Disney and Florida Republicans did to Disney in not yielding, and I think running concurrent with Elon Musk's pending takeover of Twitter, now you have Netflix sending a missive to their employees. You know, basically, if you don't like that we host, that we put Dave Chappelle comedy specials on our streaming service, then maybe Netflix isn't the place for you. A real change in attitude by Netflix brass toward these woke employees that are bitching about everything they disagree with that's on the site.
That's a great point. I heard about that this morning, and there's a lot of companies also, too, who are refraining from wading in on the Roe versus Wade debate,
yes,
too, which is very encouraging. So there are some encouraging things happen, and maybe woke corporate America is waking up to this. I don't know. That would be very encouraging.
Governor DeSantis once said, though, it was recently, that if Trump runs for president, he will not run. Do you believe that still stands?
No.
Okay.
In a word. I think DeSantis will run. He is a very ambitious person. He has done very well here in Florida. I don't know what else he would have to prove here in Florida. So I think he will run either way. That's just my prediction. That's my gut sense. What do you think?
Well, and the problem he has is, you know, he'll be midterm and then he's termed out. And I don't see Scott or Rubio going anywhere. So where does he go if he doesn't try to level up and run for national office?
Yeah.
And I know, and if Trump runs, I mean, it wouldn't make. I mean, people thought Trump DeSantis, and then he hands it over to DeSantis after a term. But the Trump DeSantis, that ticket doesn't really make sense. It's sort of two sides of the same coin, even despite the differences that we've outlined. So, I think there's a lot of incentive for him to run in 24, regardless. But, you know, 2 years is a long time. We'll see. Trump obviously would be the heavy favorite as we stand here today.
Yeah, according to the polls, he is. But, you know, I think that the, you know, polls taken a few years before something happens, I think, are extremely unreliable. I mean, Hillary Clinton was supposed to be an unbeatable candidate. If you look at the Democratic primary polls, you know, even a year before her primary, she was, oh my God, she was, you know, up 30 points.
Yeah,
so I don't think so. And I think also too, if you put Trump in, I don't know if Trump will actually debate DeSantis. But I think you put those two men on stage, and no disrespect to Trump, but I mean, at his age, he's not a great debater to begin with. I was very disappointed in his debate performance versus Biden. I mean, he should have absolutely crucified Biden, given how utterly hapless and inarticulate Biden is. And it didn't help that the moderators were, of course, extremely biased. But his debate performance were, I would say, mediocre at very best. And so you put him, you know, up on stage standing against a youthful and very articulate DeSantis. And I don't know. I think those numbers, you know, might change. I'm not saying DeSantis would win, but I think that the current polls would show Trump, you know, with a 30-point lead over DeSantis. I don't think he'd win by 30 points. I really don't.
It depends on how big the field is and so forth. But I mean, the Hillary comparison, it's I don't think that stands up. I mean, she was never a president. She was never a successful president. I mean, the goodwill that Trump has because of what he did and what he endured, that's not going to go away anytime soon, as we're seeing play out right now in the primary season.
Right, but I think that the age thing, especially as you're watching Biden age in office, I really think that voters may be more sensitive next time around to age, because we're seeing this guy just clearly deteriorate right before our very eyes. And Trump is, you know, a few years younger than Biden. What is he, 4 years younger than Biden, I think?
Yeah,
but,
something like that.
I mean,
yeah,
let's face it, in a couple more years from now, what is he going to be, 76 or so, 77? I mean,
that's young by DC standards.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, still younger than Biden and Pelosi, but, you know, he's going to be getting up there. So I don't know. I think that'll be a factor on voters' minds.
He is Dave Seminara, a former diplomat and author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, a tale of wanderlust, greed, and the quest to reach the ends of the earth. Check out his most recent piece at City Journal, The Boogeyman, talking about Ron DeSantis, as we were discussing. Dave, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This is why the PAC I recently launched is focused on governor's races and school board races and not much in between, because that's where all the action is these days in the pandemonium of the last 2 years of pandemic and even in the post-pandemic, which many don't want to believe we are in post-pandemic, like those at Evanston Township High School, which issued a directive that all students and staff must wear masks when they report to school today. The cases have leveled up to tangerine level, which is one above pineapple, and
is that when you cross the bridge to the district?
All ETHS students and staff, regardless of vaccination status, will be required to wear masks indoors at this time. Should conditions change, ETS will adjust and communicate updates to help students reduce the spread of virus. Everyone must do their part. Where I heard that before. Students and staff are asked to hold each other in loving accountability, which is the best kind of accountability, to properly wear a mask over their nose and mouth while inside the ETH building. Act as a loving sentinel of the state, the Stasi, but the loving version of the Stasi. By the way, it is dubious that ETHS can do this under state law. Under state law, school officials don't have this authority technically because it's a type of quarantine.
Right.
And that needs to be directed by the city or county health department.
County health department has to give you a piece of paper saying that.
Not that Cook County or Evanston Township Health Department wouldn't. Of course they will. But just, you know, for legally, you know, for, you know, to remember the law and so forth, I thought I'd add that. But look, this is what it's going to be in places that are run by ascientific COVIDian devotees like Evanston.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. I wonder how many seniors who are on the way out are really going to comply with this mask mandate. I mean, they're lucky it wasn't last week when it was so hot. I mean, you couldn't even barely breathe. I can't even imagine having a mask on because none of those older schools are air conditioned. But on Friday, Dan, I got an email from my other boss, Pedro Martinez, who, by the way, fully vaccinated, who, by the way, boosted, who is mild. He has COVID right now. He's got mild symptoms, so he's working from home.
Is he recovering with Bill Gates?
Yeah, he's going to be just fine. But yeah, they gave out an email. Ready? 5 o'clock Friday, because that's, you know, when they deliver bad news. Employees who do not submit proof of vaccination or receive an exemption by July 15th, 2022 will be deemed ineligible to work for CPS and will not be permitted to continue in their employment pursuant to board rules and resolutions. I don't remember the board ever voting on this, but yeah. So no more tests to stay. And if you're not vaccinated by July 15th, you're not going to have a job in the fall. Why are we continuing with this? Because it proves that the CEO of CPS, he's been vaccinated and boosted, and he has COVID. And yet he's saying you have to, you know, vaccine mandates are now required.
You know, I wonder here if they're finally, even in a place like Chicago or a place like Evanston, if they're finally out over their skis, even for CPS families, even for those aging hippies in Evanston. I wonder if they're finally over their skis on this, because, look, I get that they're going to be given credit, like, oh, we got through this together, and it was because of the masking and the vax mandates and all the COVIDian nonsense, the idiot circles and all that, that we got through this together. Okay, full stop. So, you know, we did it together, and you provided great leadership, and this is sort of what I expect the reaction from Oak Park or Evanston or Chicago CPS to be to their overlords, because they don't have any ability to think for themselves. Their minds have been taken over completely by their political overlords. That's what I think to this point. But now I wonder, once we say it's over and we're returning to pre-pandemic life, more or less, I wonder if there will be any
pushback
or backlash, even in Evanston, even in an Oak Park, even in a CPS.
And they're going to lose some really fine CPS teachers who just have refused to get vaccinated. That's their business. I don't ask why. No, they are. And
that's fine.
Enough's enough. I mean, my God, what you could try and get a religious or medical exemption.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, you have to do all that to keep your job. I just think it's so funny, and I tweeted this out, because in Chicago you can, you know, have the choice whether or not to get an abortion, but you can't choose whether or not to have a COVID vaccination. If you want to work for the city or Chicago PD,
the argument
CPS.
Is, right, you know, it's, you're a danger to others. Obviously, the abortion is you're only a danger to the baby you're going to kill, I guess. But they don't see it that way, so that's the distinction they make.
Right.
You're a this is a public health crisis.
Oh, yes.
You know, a child is a personal situation, and so that's the difference. Uh-huh. I want to get to this Washington Post op-ed. It's remarkable. This is a bioethicist, a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. Wow. Her name is Nita Farahani. And she doesn't know what to do. Does not know what to do. We parents of unvaccinated children need more guidance. As mask mandates and other protections fall away and the vaccines are delayed for under five, we're wondering what we should do to protect our children.
Oh, my God. This is like that crazy lady in Chicago who hasn't left her house because her one-year-old isn't vaccinated.
And they have
no comorbidities.
We parents of young children who can't be vaccinated feel abandoned at this late stage of the pandemic.
Oh, my God.
Federal officials, it seems, have decided to leave it up to us to figure out how to navigate coronavirus risks for our children. The lack of information has bred distrust in parents while putting public health agencies in an unenviable catch-22 as they prepare to finally, hopefully, vaccinate children under five.
Did they not know what's going on in the world? Okay.
This is Duke University professor.
Oh, my God.
Either the risks to this age group are minimal, which potentially weakens the imminent message to vaccinate children under five, or they are more substantial and public officials have failed to adequately advise parents about how to protect children in the absence of a vaccine. It's not too late, though, for public health agencies to correct course and issue guidance for what we should be doing and not doing to protect our young unvaccinated children from COVID short-term and long-term harms. She complains about the mixed messaging. She's voraciously consumed all the public health information out there, and she's baffled. I'm a bioethicist who, stuck in parental limbo, has become a fervent amateur epidemiology researcher, devouring information to decipher the risk to her youngest child. But like other parents, I'm exhausted from the effort and confused by the data. And I believe that public health agencies, not me, should be doing the work of summarizing the most salient findings and explaining how to act on them. Even as she writes, she's been comforted that the short-term odds of death and other severe outcomes for the youngest have remained quite low relative to older populations.
Practically non-existent.
And absolute terms, nothing relative about it, relative to, say, the flu, which I don't recall her writing any op-eds about. But this is how damaged the minds of the COVIDians have become. And so, I don't know, I guess that Duke University professor, since she sort of fits a part of the profile in places like Evanston or Oak Park or Chicago, a part, not the total profile, I guess I don't expect much of a revolt to the reimposition of these mandates or the imposition of new mandates, like going from a vax or test to stay to just vax in Chicago. Eric Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Just wanted to let you guys know that last Friday, District 97 Oak Park had an emergency meeting due to the extreme number of COVID cases that they were experiencing. And they sent my children home Monday because of the fact that they had a sore throat, and they said they had to come back. Well, they missed 3 days of school, and of course they didn't have COVID. They tested negative for COVID. But, you know, every single symptom that a person could possibly have is covered under COVID symptoms. So if your kid comes to school with a little bit of a runny nose due to allergies, they'll send them home and they'll be uneducated again for another week or however long they hold them out. And the meeting, they discussed having a mandatory mask requirement, but they decided they couldn't do that. So right now they said they were going to strongly recommended, and that that may make people think that it's actually required.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the call, Eric. You know, if your kid has COVID symptoms, which as Eric says, basically anything could be a COVID symptom.
Right.
Just say, tell the school officials, hey, don't worry about it.
What?
We had him tested. It's not COVID. He has tuberculosis, but it's fine, so we're sending him to school. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. I still have that hanging over my head, the Valparaiso University. I'm teaching a couple of online MBA courses this summer, and they've given me a special exemption because I'm online. Apparently, through the computer, they haven't figured out a way to attach COVID disease. So I'm okay with that. But I have to get in my religious exemption letter, which I will be composing, so that I can be considered. Otherwise, I'll be dropped in the fall. I'm thinking, too, are children playing with, like, soap bubble things? You know, you pull the little ring out, and then you blow the bubble, and the bubbles. Is that bio-warfare now?
It sounds like, though, Ralph, you're fortunate to have a employment environment that features loving accountability, which has to be nice for you.
I do feel loved when they say, do everything we say or we're going to drop you like a bad habit.
Gives you a good feeling, doesn't it? Thanks for the call, Ralph. Uh-huh. Steve, Southside.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I put this squarely on the shoulders of the nincompoops that advocate or go and get tested. There's no upside to getting tested anymore. If you got it, you go home. If you don't have it, you go home. So anybody who goes to get these tests, all they're doing is driving these red light, green lights, and they're basically handing over the lockdowns to them. They're giving them more ammunition for it.
Oh, just wait Thanks, until Dave. School's over. For 43% of tests every day in Chicago are the result of testing CPS students and teachers. So I don't know what they're going to do. I mean, how are they going to keep this? It's going to be just wait till school's out.
Andy Hinsdale.
You know, the schools are the last bastion of this leftist, so they're going to let go at the very last possible minute. But, you know, I have to have a condo in this godforsaken city because I still have a company here that I have to come back and run every once in a while. And even in my condo, which is populated like 98% by T-hats and their shrieking significant others, with the risk level in Chicago up to medium, even my condo has not gone back to mandating masks. They're just recommending them as optional. So I don't know if it's ever going to leave the schools, but even the P-hats in Chicago are starting to get tired. It's crazy.
Thanks, Andy. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, you guys. By now, I'm telling you, I'm so sick of this. By now, if you listen to these idiots who run your school and you put a mask on your face, you're a stupider idiot. And as the old saying goes with, you know, if you're a Democrat and you're under, I don't know, 40, I think it's probably 50 by now, you're a fool. And remember that saying?
If you're under 40, you don't have a heart. If you're over 40, you don't have a head.
Yeah, whatever. I reject
that cliche, but okay, go ahead.
Well, whatever. And then the cuckoos out up in Evanston are over their skis. I think they're just cuckoo bananas.
Well, you know, thanks for the call, Mary Kay. You know how we'll find out? We'll find out in the school board elections in 2023. Find out a lot about who is being held lovingly accountable at the school district level for what has happened over the last 2 years, next year, 2023. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.